When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Have you ever wondered what it's like to be buried in an avalanche?
Weird foreign feeling of despair.
Or how it feels to crash a skydive?
I remember hearing a thud, feeling my body hit the ground.
Or how you would react if you were being attacked by an alligator?
At the end of my leg is this huge alligator head on my leg.
These are the stories you'll hear on the podcast called What Was That Like? True stories told by the actual person who went through it. You'll hear from a victim of an attack.
Dragging me into the bathroom and saying, I'm going to kill you. Now you're going to die.
You'll hear from a man who discovered a baby.
How could this be? How could there be a baby on the ground?
And you'll hear actual 911 calls.
Clinton County 911.
There's a man at my back door. He's trying to get in.
What Was That Like is a podcast about real people in unreal situations. Search for What Was That Like on any podcast app or at whatwasthatlike.com.
This episode is sponsored by Craft Beer Delivery Club, Beer 52. Good. Was that fun? Did you have fun?
Yeah, it was great. Thank you. Yeah, are you going to cut out the bits where I sound stupid?
The whole thing?
That's made my day. Thank you. Yeah. I'm going to cut out the whole thing. We're going to record it next week.
Today, I'm honored to have on the show the eminent Professor Sue Black. Now, the eagle-eyed or eared among you will note that a Professor Sue Black has already been on the show. However, in truly extraordinary circumstances, or at least one hell of a coincidence, this is a different Professor Sue Black from the forensic anthropologist of episode 37. And most marvelously of all, the two professors know and have met one another. Anyway, I better get introducing today's Professor Sue Black, who is an award-winning computer scientist and technology evangelist at Durham University. She is perhaps best known for her instrumental work in saving Bletchley Park, the home of the Codebreakers during the Second World War. For those who don't know, Bletchley Park is the famous setting where Alan Turing's machine cracked the Enigma code, meaning the Allies were able to know what the Germans were getting up to. At least, that was the plot of the film, The Imitation Game, with Benedict Cumberbatch and Keira Knightley. In reality, Turing played a key role in a huge team of people all working together to crack those codes. What went on there was top secret, and many of the thousands stationed there went to their deaths decades later without uttering a word about it. We're still finding out more about what really went on there, but what we do know is that it was set to be demolished and redeveloped before Sue's intervention. She's been through what she describes as different degrees of shit, having grown up in an abusive home. She found herself with no real qualifications with a couple of kids in her early 20s, so to become a professor of her standing is no mean feat. She talks about her upbringing as well before we get into the Bletchley Park history and future. Her book, Saving Bletchley Park, was the most successful crowdfunded project of all time, and it documents how Sue managed to make use of the new medium, at the time anyway, of Twitter to unite passionate people from around the world, including the wonderful Stephen Fry, to come together and save the park. There's now even a museum there which you can go and visit. Get Sue's book in all the normal places, Saving Bletchley Park, that is. There'll be a link in the show notes. We'll talk about computers, Codebreakers, and what it was like meeting Stephen Fry and the Queen. By the way, I did ask about quantum computing, but Sue informed me that wasn't her speciality, so we talked about other stuff. And the reason I mention that is just because I took that out
but I reference it later on when talking about the Queen. So just in case you were confused at that point, that's what that was about. Quantum computing. Last week, Apple were nice enough to feature this podcast in their carousel, so at the top of the app. So welcome to all the new listeners, and please make sure to subscribe to this show. You can find video clips on youtube.com/AndrewGold1 and get a bonus interview with every episode on patreon.com/AndrewGold or just in the Patreon app if you download it. Follow me on AndrewGold_OK on Twitter and Instagram, and you'll find Sue on @Dr_Black. Here she is.
Changing my background.
Oh, look at that.
Ta-da! I'm in Durham. Well, I'm actually in London.
Yeah, I like that. I guess you are a computer scientist, so you're good at that stuff.
Yep. Yeah.
My concern was because I got the similar headphones to you, but then when I've done that, I get like loads of weird stuff around the headphone area, like
well,
the background.
Well, yeah, I've got it here, look. You can like, no, this side.
Yeah, I wonder if I should do it.
I'm not quite sure what to do about that.
I had a funny thing recently, actually, because... there was a blue painting that's like a square, which actually...
Yeah.
Oh, it's here.
Oh, that's your real background. Wow.
Yeah, this is me. Just a white,
it's not
it's
just
a white wall.
Blurred out. Yeah.
Yeah. And this blue painting, basically, the I rent this flat and in Berlin. And it's
yeah.
like a...
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
How is Berlin?
So, oh, it's... whenever people ask that, I always look out the window as if like they'll know how it is. It's fine. Yes. It's good.
Everyone's okay.
Yeah, they seem all right out there. Although actually out that very window yesterday, I saw a bunch of people getting arrested and they were like thrown on the floor, arms behind their
backs. Oh my God. Yeah. Yeah.
It's all kicking off. But yeah, the person who owns this flat, her sister made that painting.
Oh, wow.
And so she got in touch and she was like, look, this is a copyright infringement.
Really?
Yeah, she was actually very nice about it.
She
but
wasn't
she was
happy
like,
that you're publicising her painting.
Well, she was like, can you at least put my name in it? Which... I understand, like, you know, it's art and stuff. I didn't even notice it. It was just there. So I just said, like, I was like, look, it's. I'll do some of the old, I'll backdate some of them and put your name in it.
Yeah.
But, like, in the future, I'm just going to take it. Because it's a podcast.
Yeah, take it down. Yeah, yeah.
But I get it as well. She doesn't want her art stolen. You know, like, people, they must have that a lot. They're,
oh, I see. Yeah. Yeah. But then surely it's good for your art to be publicised, isn't it?
If I write her name.
Right, okay. Yeah, right. I'll just shut up. I don't really know.
I don't know either. I don't know. She's probably right. We don't. What do we know? So I'm recording, as you know. This is all
going out. Oh,
okay.
Yes. Oh, well, all of it. Oh, my goodness. Have I said anything libelous?
You've said everything you've said has been libelous so far. although, is it slander? Don't know. So,
well, yeah, I can never remember what's what anyway.
Oh,
yes, it's slander. It's not libel, is it? Anyway.
It's all the same, isn't it? It's all whatever the things you've said have been very offensive and horrible, but I'll cut some of those out. Tell me, how did you meet the other Sue Black? So people listening to this will know Sue Black. And now you're also Sue Black. How did you come across her?
What do you mean I'm also? I thought I was the first one. How rude.
I don't know which of you was first.
No. Well, she was born a year before me.
That's her then.
So I guess that's her, yeah. Right. No, it's really funny. So I've known about her for 25 or 30 years. We've known about each other. And I first saw her name because I picked up a copy of The Guardian on the Tube, like the weekend thing, magazine, and it had a quote from somebody, you know, like blah, blah, blah. And I was just reading through these quotes and it said, Dr. Sue Black. And I was like, but hang on, that's me like next year or something when I get my PhD. How weird. So then I knew there was someone called Dr. Sue Black that wasn't me. And then what happened after that? I think maybe I emailed her to say, oh, I'm now Dr. Sue Black as well. And then we sort of corresponded like every couple of years or something when someone would mistake us for each other. And as we've both got more and more famous over the last 20 years or so, then... Now we get mistaken for each other all the time now. So I'm always getting people on Facebook or LinkedIn or Twitter, like even today on Twitter, mistaking us for, you know, us for each other. And so like for the last kind of maybe 10 years, we've sort of been threatening to meet up. And then when I got the job at Durham and she was at Dundee, it wasn't that far
a way for us to actually meet up. And so then she invited me up to be part of a project that she was running. They had this a big kind of like workshop day to be like their digital expert. So I was like, oh yeah, cool, we actually get to meet up. So I got the train up from Durham up to Dundee. And the night before the meeting, I met with a friend who works at Dundee Uni. I walked past a toilet, actually, and the other Professor Sue Black walked out. So we kind of like bumped into each other in front of the loo and went, oh, my God, it's you. Oh, my God, it's you. So that was really cool. And then I got a selfie with her and her skull that she has in her office because the loo was next door to her office. So we got a selfie together. We're like, oh, I'm so glad to finally meet you kind of thing. And then spent the next day with her. As part of the project and just kind of like hung out a bit. And now we're like kind of besties.
That's nice. You're lucky she's not a murderer or something. Then you'd be getting hate mail.
True.
Do you know the other Andrew Gold?
I don't know. Who's the other Andrew Gold?
He's a singer from the 80s. He's sung,
which like, band?
Oh, what a lonely boy.
I remember that song. Yeah,
that was Andrew Gold. He died a few years ago. He was like 53 or something.
That's younger than me. That's not good.
He was young. He was young. I forgot to ask. Are you able to record on your side?
Yeah. What do you want me to?
Do you have like QuickTime or something?
iPhone. Little red button. Yeah. Yes,
you got it.
I've clicked it. Yeah. Thank you. I don't know everything. I don't even know you have to click record.
That's one of the annoying things, I suppose, if you're a computer scientist, people must expect.
They expect me to know everything about everything to do with technology, how to fix their printer through to what's the latest innovations in AI. Yeah.
What does a computer scientist know? What do you know?
Well, it kind of feels like nothing and everything. It's quite weird. I guess I got my degree in 93. So that's a long time ago. Then my PhD in 2001. So I've kind of been studying and researching and looking at stuff and reading for a very long time. And like I feel like the more I know, the less I know, in a way. I don't quite know how to explain it, but yeah, I kind of feel like I know nothing. And then you meet someone who doesn't actually know much about a subject they say they know a lot about, and you're like, oh, I know so much more than them about it. So it's just a bit weird. It's impossible to quantify, I think.
Is it my head is imagining, because I know nothing about any of this, so my head is imagining lots of ones and zeros and putting them all together, and for some reason that makes a computer.
Yeah, that's it, basically. Yeah,
is that it?
Well, in fact, I've got a podcast coming out, or we've got a podcast coming out at Durham, which is 100 Moments That Rocked Computer Science, and we talk about exactly that sort of thing.
Okay, because I did a year of computer science at AS level when I was 17.
Okay,
and it was called computing, and that was it.
Yeah,
and I thought it was going to be basically this teacher cornered me and a couple of mates, and it was like our last day of the year.
Yeah,
and he said, you should do computing, and I think he knew nobody had signed up to it, and he needed somebody to sign up. So he was like, were like, is it hard? And he was like, no, it's basically like MS Word. You just like open Word and learn how to do this and that. And we were like, oh, well, that sounds like a fourth A level that's going to be really easy, an easy A.
Yeah.
We turned up the next year and it was all just like, looking at these books from the 1950s and 60s. Yeah, it was, 1010, all this stuff. And I was just like, oh, my God, what have I signed up to? This is impossible. I couldn't do it.
Did you pass? No.
No, I failed.
No. Yeah. Oh, well.
Yeah. I didn't take the exam.
I haven't got any A levels, so I won't worry about it.
That's right. Tell me a bit about your early life, would you please?
Sure.
Yeah, go on. What there's a bit at the beginning of your book about your brilliant book about that. So please, for the listeners.
I guess I've been geeky from an early age, and like my favourite thing to buy my pocket money as a kid was maths textbooks. I was always kind of into maths and that sort of thing. I come from like an average family. Both my parents are nurses. Brother and sister are twins, 5 years younger than me. And everything was fine, really. Just kind of not nondescript, nothing terrible, nothing amazing happening. And then my mum died when I was 12, unfortunately. And then my dad remarried the next year, possibly to the wrong person. From my point of view anyway, and I sort of went from living in a functional family to a dysfunctional family, I guess, and I was very unhappy. It was a lot of emotional cruelty, a bit of physical cruelty. I ended up looking for some reason at like tables of levels of neglect a while ago for something, I can't remember what it was, but then saw that what actually happened to us was severe neglect, which I hadn't even realized before, because we didn't have enough food, we didn't have clean clothes, that sort of thing.
Oh, shit.
And so I left home as soon as I could, which was when I was 16, lived with my friend's family for a year, sort of around the corner. And then I was doing my A-levels, but it was just impossible doing school. And I was working in the evenings and at weekends to pay my rent. It just, you know, wasn't working out. I was falling asleep at school. So I left school, got a job working for the council, then wanted to move to London. So I got a job working with refugees in London, which I loved. And then did the same thing in Hampshire, then applied to be a student nurse. So I did that. Didn't like that at all. I was too shy. I'm not shy now, but I've always been I was extremely shy. So I've had to work really hard to overcome that. And so I hadn't thought about the fact that if you're a nurse, you have to talk to lots of people you don't know, which, you know, like once I was in there, I was like, oh yeah, why didn't I think about this before? But never mind. So I didn't like that at all. And then then I got a job working for RCA Records, a record company, in the accounts department. So it was maths and music, going to see bands for free. So that was all cool. Did that for 2 years, then got married, had my daughter when I was 21. And then I thought, well, I'll have another baby, go back to work. The other baby turned out to be twin boys when I was 23. So at 23, I had 3 kids under 2.5. Mm. And then unfortunately, my marriage broke down, ended up in a women's refuge. Had to start life again. So that I was still in London. I was in Ladbroke Grove. Start life again in South London, in Brixton. And then, so I got my daughter into school. She was 4 then, and got the boys into playgroup. And then I thought, okay, so what am I going to do now? I need to earn money to support my family. I'm now a single parent. But realised I'd left school at 16. Hadn't worked for a few years, so I was going to be on, you know, working in a supermarket or something, which is fine, but I wouldn't have earned enough money to feed a family of 4 with that, or pay for childcare or whatever. So I knew that going back to work wasn't an option. So I thought, okay, well, why don't I try studying again? Went along to the local college, which was Southwark College in London. Luckily, they had like a fast track maths course there, which I did, which gave you the equivalent of 2 A-levels in maths in 1 year. And then got into South Bank Uni, studied computing at South Bank for a degree for 4 years, got a 2-1, applied for a PhD position, got that, did a PhD for 7 years, but in the middle of that applied for a lectureship, became a lecturer, and then for quite some time, well, since then, apart from a sort of break in the middle, I've been in academia, really.
Being a lecturer is a long way from the shy nurse that you were. You couldn't speak to the patients. And then, yeah, I mean, that scares the hell out of me. The idea of going up in front of how was that at the beginning?
Yeah, scary. I didn't sleep the night before our first class. And luckily, the first teaching I did, I just had about 10 students and they were first years. So it wasn't too bad. And I was teaching them maths. Okay. So it was probably like the least scary, but I still didn't sleep the night before. And I can remember sitting in the loo before going into the class thinking, I just want to die. I don't want to go in there. Yeah, I was just horrified at the thought that I'd have to stand in front of a class and teach students. And then I just thought, I'm going to pretend I'm someone else. So I pretended that I was my best friend, who's like an IT consultant. I just pretended I was her, my friend Hazel, and went in. I'm just like, I'm channeling Hazel. I'm Hazel. Wow. Like through the whole class. And it seemed to work. And the students seemed to have a good time. And I quite enjoyed it. And I came out totally buzzing at the end of it. And, you know, and so then I just kind of built it up from there, really. You know, it was such a shock that I actually loved doing it. You know, I wasn't expecting that at all. I was expecting 2 hours of trauma that I had to kind of get through. But actually, it was fun. And then just kind of like built up class size up to sort of 150 over the next few years, you know, getting used to that and teaching masters and, you know, like third year degree students kind of gradually, I guess, step by step. And yeah, each time I was taking a step up, I was extremely nervous and, you know, then kind of from then on, I ended up being on like radio and TV. Mm. And stuff kind of over my career. So each time I've been like horrified at the next step up, but then I've just kind of got on with it. And then, you know, it's like anything, once you get used to it, it's easy.
But it's
like if you've never done it before, you've not had any training for it, and then suddenly you have to do it, it's very difficult.
That adrenaline rush is quite addictive. Mm. It's a little bit like karaoke or whatever, and people will push you all day, go on, do your song, and you're like, oh, and you're so nervous. But you do one and you're like, oh, I'll stay up here and do a second one now.
I've never got that far. You just remind me that the only time I've done karaoke, for some reason I chose it for my own party, even though I don't like singing in public. And again, I chose a duet and I got my friend Hazel to do it with me. And I just held the microphone in front of her the whole time. So I'd like, no one heard me.
What was the song? Do you remember?
My Way, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, which actually isn't a duet, but I must have decided I need someone else up there with me.
I'm trying to think of a good duet to do. I like that Robbie Williams song with Kylie Minogue, Kids. Do you
know yeah, that? I can't remember. You sing it.
I've got a... how does it go? Oh. I've got a touch, da-da, was it too many times? You're dancing with the chairman of the board. Take a ride on my 12-cylinder symphony. You got other plans. Do you know that?
No. I'm not down with the Kids, obviously, because I don't know it.
And it's called Kids. But yeah. That was 20 years ago now.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
God, I'm getting old.
Yeah. Well, we all are, and that's a horrible
True.
Thing.
Well, it's either get older or... there's an alternative, which is actually worse.
Oh, my God. Well, I did an episode a couple of weeks ago on assisted suicide.
Oh, really?
Hmm.
Wow. I'll have to have listened to that.
Dr. Death. Yeah, Dr. Death. Philip Nitschke is his name.
Okay.
He's an Australian. He goes around sort of...
helping people.
Trying to circumvent laws that don't allow it. So that he invents machines so it's that he's not helping. They push the button themselves. So, yeah.
That sounds interesting. Well, yeah, but I'll have to listen to that. It sounds interesting.
Yes, I hope you do.
Hey, it's Andrew. If you're enjoying Heretics, there's another podcast I want to recommend to you, especially if climate change, global conflicts, and an upcoming election are making you feel like we're on the brink of disaster. What Could Go Right is hosted by Progress Network founder Zachary Carabel and executive director Emma Varvalukas. On What Could Go Right, the hosts sit down with expert guests to discuss the world's most pressing issues without resorting to pessimism or despair that we hear so often. Instead, they look back at how far society has come and look forward at what it will take to achieve an even brighter future. Is progress on the way? They may not have all the answers, but on What Could Go Right, they're asking the key questions. Tune in to hear interviews with upcoming guests like writer Coleman Hughes, CNN host Fareed Zakaria, and economist Alison Schrager. If you're looking for a weekly dose of optimistic ideas from smart people, join them every Wednesday on What Could Go Right, available wherever you get your podcasts. A few decades ago, private citizens used to be largely that, private. What's changed? The internet. Think about everything you've browsed, searched for, watched or tweeted. Now imagine all of that data being crawled through, collected and aggregated by third parties into a permanent public record. Your record. Having your private life exposed for others to see was once something only celebrities worried about. But in an era where everyone is online, everyone is a public figure. To keep my data private when I go online, I turn to ExpressVPN. Did you know there are hundreds of data brokers out there whose sole business is to buy and sell your data? The worst part is they don't have to tell you who they're selling it to or get your consent. One of these data points is your IP address. Data harvesters use your IP to uniquely identify you and your location. But with ExpressVPN, my connection gets rerouted through an encrypted server and my IP address is masked. Every time I turn ExpressVPN on, I'm given a random IP address shared by other ExpressVPN customers. That makes it more difficult for third parties to identify me and harvest my data. And the best part is how easy ExpressVPN is to use. No matter what device you're on, phone, laptop, or smart TV, all you have to do is tap one button to get protected. So if, like me, you believe that your data is your business, secure yourself with the number one rated VPN on the market. Visit expressvpn.com/heretics and get 3 extra months for free. That's expressvpn.com/heretics. Go to expressvpn.com/heretics to learn more.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
And tell me, how does one end up in a women's refuge?
Well, so, you know, I woke up one morning and my ex-husband was threatening to kill me and the children. So I thought, okay, it's time to go. It's time to leave. And, you know, I mean, before that, he threatened me a few times, but I suppose I haven't really taken it that seriously. But then when he was like very, very, very angry and threatening to kill the kids, I just thought, well, I can't even risk that that's going to happen. Anything's going to happen like that in any way, because they were really little. Like, my daughter was 3 and the boys were 1. So what I did was packed a suitcase very quickly and ran down the road to my friend's house. And then she said, phone Women's Aid. So she found the number and I phoned up Women's Aid, which is a charity which runs refugees around the country. And so I phoned them up and they said, we'll ring you back when we've got a place for you. So I was like, okay, then. Put the phone down, and then like a minute later the phone rang again, so I picked it up thinking it was Women's Aid, and it was actually my ex-husband shouting, I know where you are, I'm coming to kill you all now, kind of thing.
Oh my God.
So I put the phone down and ran down to my other friend further down the road and told her what had been happening and phoned up Women's Aid again, and they gave me an address in South London. And so I didn't have any money at all, borrowed £20 off my friend to get a cab, got us all in a cab and down to South London. Then when we got to the address, was interviewed about what happened and, you know, checking we were all okay and that sort of thing. And then by, I think like that evening, maybe about 5 p.m, they gave me some emergency money to buy some food for the kids. And then I think about 5 or 6 p.m, took us over to a refuge, and basically we had a room to live in for the four of us, and yeah, like in a big shared house, really.
I just don't understand how one goes. It just seems really extreme, doesn't it, to be threatening to kill someone?
Yeah.
I just don't.
He obviously had some issues.
Yeah, I guess so. Oh, God. Well, it looks like things are looking up now, though.
Oh, yeah, right? Completely.
Yeah, that's good. Tell me, let's get onto computers, right, a little bit. And then we'll get onto Bletchley as well.
Okay, cool.
Bletchley is a very interesting thing. But what is it? Just a layman's term, right? I want to actually go, what is a computer?
It's a machine. It's a machine that does things, that kind of reads, can only understand ones and zeros at or sort of on and off at a basic level. And it's a machine that you can program to do things for you. Is that basic enough? Yeah.
No, that is. And I'm happy because I feel like I was right. It is ones and zeros. I had a vague suspicion it was ones and zeros. but it's just remarkable. I'm talking to you across this thing right now. And this is this all ones and zeros? Is this what's happening?
Yeah, at some level, yeah. It's like layers built upon layers of stuff so that at the top level, we can understand what's going on and we can interact with it. No, it's just incredible. It really, really is.
I don't get it. See, and I think most listeners won't either get it. We can't. Maybe we just can't get it.
Well, it's hard for me as well. Yeah. You know, I mean, you know, it's hard for me to even, like, think about it at that level. In a way, you have to kind of, like, I think, to be able to understand it, you have to just look at one kind of level of abstraction at a time. So just at the ones and zeros levels, and maybe a level and maybe a bit built on top of that. But to be able to connect them all together all the time, I think you'd go insane.
It must be magic. I think it's magic.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'm lying. It's magic.
You're lying. It's magic.
Don't tell anyone, though. Don't tell anyone.
I'm not telling anyone except all the listeners, but hopefully they won't tell anyone.
No.
Tell me about your book. Tell me about it. Tell me about Saving Bletchley Park.
Well, so I ran a campaign from 2008 to 2011 to save Bletchley Park. I mean, I first went up there in 2003, didn't really know much about the place, and came away the first time having found out that, you know, I thought it was kind of 50 old blokes that worked there. But in fact, during the Second World War, but in fact, it was more than 10,000 people and more than 8,000 women. And I'd not seen that kind of story out there anywhere, right? So in 2003, I came away thinking, I've got to raise the profile of the women that worked at Bletchley Park. And then got some funding for an oral history project, recorded the memories of some of the women that worked there, some of the code breakers. And then at the launch of that project, the director of Bletchley Park at the time said that they might have to close because they didn't have enough money, basically, and the visitor numbers were dropping, stuff like that. And then I got invited up to a reception at Bletchley Park, this is in 2008, and did a full tour of the site, which I'd not done before, and found out that the work that was done there was said to have shortened World War II by 2 years. And at that time, 11 million people a year were dying. So potentially the work that was done there had saved 22 million lives. And I just thought to myself, and this place might close. That's ridiculous. I've got to do something about it. So kind of going back to my career. So, you know, I was an academic, I was a lecturer, senior lecturer, principal lecturer. So by now in 2008, I was head of department. So I was head of department at University of Westminster, which meant that I could email all the heads of professors of computing in the country and ask them basically to help save Bletchley Park. And, you know, and got lots of, got enthusiastic response from lots of heads and professors straight away. I emailed a few journalists to try and like raise the profile of Bletchley Park, and Rory Kefflin-Jones was one of them. And so the BBC technology correspondent. So he then interviewed me, I think the next week at Bletchley Park, saying, I'm ashamed to be British. Why don't we look after our heritage, kind of thing? And then that went out on BBC News and like was front page of the BBC website and stuff. So it was kind of like the beginning of a campaign. And there was sort of like a big sort of crescendo of a response from people in terms of emails and stuff. But then it all sort of died down and then I didn't really know what else to do. And it wasn't really until the end of that year, so to end of 2008, beginning of 2009, that I'd started using Twitter. So I'd signed up for Twitter in 2007 and just thought, what is this rubbish? Set up a blog and then got Stephen Fry involved because he tweeted a selfie of himself and some friends stuck in a lift in Centre Point. So that was back in February 2009. And I just saw the photo of him and thought, Stephen Fry, he must be interested in Bletchley Park. You know, I know he loves technology. I know he loves history. So I sent him. So luckily he was following me. I sent him several direct messages on Twitter. And he responded by tweeting a link to my blog the next day. And I'd been getting about 50 hits a day on my blog, which I thought was great. But then that day I got 8,000 hits. After he tweeted, and that day I was the most retweeted person in the world on Twitter. Yeah, amazing. So it really, I was kind of like learning how to run a campaign as I went, you know, following my nose as I went along, really. I didn't really know what I was doing. But that was amazing. So I was like, okay, it's obvious once you know it. If you get key influential people that care about the same things, you can have a big impact really quickly. So I think that was a real turning point for the campaign, from being sort of my hobby, I suppose, into being an actual campaign where lots of people got involved. After 3 years, they got 4.1 million from the Heritage Lottery Fund. And they'd applied for Heritage Lottery funding just before I started the campaign and got turned down. So I think kind of raising awareness and profile made a big difference in terms of, you know, they were then seen as a viable option for funding, whereas before they weren't. So it took 3 years in the end.
But then what was Stephen Fry like? Was it nice meeting Steve? Sorry.
I know, it's really funny, isn't it? Because like I'm not fazed to meeting anyone. You know, like the Queen, just anyone these days.
Did you meet the Queen?
Yeah, a couple of times.
What was she like, and what was Stephen Fry like?
Oh, she's very quiet and polite. So I can't even remember what she said. But just, you know, whatever. It's not like we had a long conversation.
Yeah, she probably pushed you about quantum computing and you were like, look, I don't know all that stuff. That's not my specialty, Queenie. Come on.
Yeah, that is, in fact, you just remind me, that was our conversation. No, I think she said, I don't know, lovely to meet you or something. Yeah, I can't remember.
Was that related to Bletchley that you got to meet her or was other stuff?
I don't actually know. No, I think it's just from being in tech. I got invited to a technology reception at Bletchley Park. Oh, not cool. A Bletchley Park, at Buckingham Palace.
Got Bletchley on the brain.
Yeah, totally. At Buckingham Palace. Well, the Queen did. So after the campaign, the Queen did come up to Bletchley Park as well. So they're all sort of connected in a way. But yeah, I don't know. It was a reception for people in tech in the UK. Okay. So I met her then and a few other times. But Stephen Fry, he's the only person that I felt kind of shy of out of everybody I've met. Like, I think, you know, in the last 20 years, I was just a bit like, oh, what do I say? Oh, I don't know. So, you know, I just pretended again that I wasn't shy.
Is this because you were starstruck? Because he's just, you know, such a big brain.
Yeah, I guess so. And I just think, you know, when it's someone that you've known for a long time, obviously not, you know, known, as in known, not really known. known about, and you know, I really like things that he's done, and he speaks sense a lot of the time, and he's, you know, he's obviously, yeah, just seems like an all-round kind of great guy. And then to actually meet him, it's just a bit weird, you know. Whereas if it's someone that you haven't kind of, you know, like the Queen, I didn't feel, not to disrespect the Queen, of course, but I didn't feel nervous. In fact, I didn't even know I was going to meet the Queen, to be honest, because we went to this technology reception at Buckingham Palace, and I was queuing up with my friend Emma to, like, you arrive, you put your coats in the sort of cloakroom place, and then you go upstairs, and then you get given a glass of Prosecco or champagne. I don't know. I can't tell the difference. Standing in a queue. They both taste lovely. In a queue with a drink. And there's like, I don't know, say 50 people in front of us, kind of like chatting away in pairs, and then going through an arch, like into another room, I'm guessing. And so we're just chatting away. How are you? How are you? We haven't seen each other for ages. Gradually making our way forwards in this queue. And then we sort of get to the doorway, and then a guy in uniform, like, takes my glass from me, and I had a card as well, which I think had my name on, and so he took that from me in a nice way, not in a horrible way. And then, oh, the Queen's right there for me to shake hands with. So the Queen was just kind of like around the corner inside the arch, so I was like, oh, so that's why I can't remember what she said.
Do you shake the Queen's hands?
Yes, she had gloves on. Yeah,
firm, but not handshake,
like, not vigorous. No, I don't think so. But again, I can't remember. It was just such a shock, a nice shock. And then there was the Duke of Edinburgh. And actually, I saw the Duke of Edinburgh was like next there for me to shake hands with. And I just thought, oh, please say something rude about my hair, because I've got bright red hair. I thought he might just say something rude, but he didn't. So I was a bit disappointed. He just said something nice. Yeah. No, so, and that was it. And then we're kind of in a reception. But yeah, so I met the Queen, but I had no clue that that was going to happen at all.
I guess the Stephen Fry bit's more nerve-wracking, because you had to entertain him, so to speak, as you were showing him around Bletchley. Yeah. Whereas the Queen, you're not expected to say anything to the Queen.
No, true.
In fact, it's probably better that you don't. It's not encouraged that you go off piste with her.
No, exactly. Oh. Yeah, so yeah, no, Stephen Fry was absolutely lovely. We'd spent a day with him at Bletchley Park in May of 2009 when he came up for the day. And, you know, yeah, he was taken on a tour, and Rory Kefren-Jones came along as well. Christian Payne, documentally, who's one of the guys that first kind of got in touch through Twitter, who's an amazing social media person. And we did a tour and ended up bumping into one of the veterans there. And it's just this amazing moment, because Stephen Fry is really tall, right? He's like 6'5" or something, I'm not sure. And there was this lady who was one of the veterans who was walking around with her family. And I think like Stephen Fry saw her and like said, oh, did you work here? And she was like, yes. So then they had this chat, and he's absolutely massive, and she was tiny, like 5 foot. And then so I think he knelt down, and so they had like this little conversation together, and it was so lovely. Lovely, you know. And it was so nice that he got to meet one of the veterans as well, you know, on his tour around. But no, he's a great guy.
I saw him at an airport once. I think it was Luton. Because I was picking someone up, and he was on their plane. So they had texted me before saying, Stephen Fry's on my plane. So I was like, I'll come pick you up. And I was stood there. I've never seen somebody walk through an airport at that speed. Because obviously he's knackered. He's cut off a plane. He doesn't want
to. He doesn't want to talk to anybody.
He was down and out. And I was like, oh. You know, there were people with like their book autograph, and he was just out. You know, it must be knackered. Yeah. And you're that famous.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a level of fame.
Yeah. No, I've had one day of that sort of fame. Just because I got the Social Impact Award at the Grace Hopper Conference in the US in 2017, I think. So flew over to Orlando and was at this conference. And so I got to give a speech at the beginning of the conference to 17,000 women in tech. So again, that's another kind of level in terms of speaking in front of people. So I was a little bit nervous, but you know, it was all good. And it's funny, because I saw Melinda Gates was kind of like pacing up and down. She was after me, like, and I was like, oh my goodness, you know, I've kind of made it. And so went on stage, gave my speech, and then for the rest of the conference, I had people coming up to me for the whole conference for 3 whole days saying, oh, Sue, can we get a selfie? I loved your talk, blah, blah, blah. So it was just utterly amazing.
And at the same time, after when that happens all the time, yeah. I was like, I even like went to the loo. And as I came out the cubicle, someone said, Sue, I loved your talk and wanted to shake hands with me in the loo.
Let me wash them first.
Yeah, no, that's what I was thinking. Don't you want me to wash my hands? But it was lovely. But at the same time, it's really, really exhausting. Yeah. And so after about 3 or 4 hours of that, like continuously, wherever we went anywhere, my friend just grabbed me and just like pulled me into a talk somewhere and sat me down in the audience because there was a talk on stage, right? So no one could come up to me. And I was like, oh yeah, wouldn't I think of this? Just to like have a breather of sitting with no one talking to me or asking me for a selfie. Yeah. But it was just a little taste of what it must be like to be...
Yeah.
Mega famous, and it's lovely, but it's so hard. It's really, really like wears you out so much.
Yeah, this is why I've made a concerted effort to not be successful. So many of us have seen. I'll distract from my terrible joke.
I'm Richard Serrett. Join me on Strange Planet for in-depth conversations with the world's top paranormal investigators, alien abductees, Bigfoot trackers, monster hunters, time travelers, alternative archaeologists, remote viewers, and more.
As I was on the way to Area 51, I was stopping on the side of the road and just taking measurements, and I found this one spot where time slowed down by a fraction of a second. It's not supposed to do that.
From the two big categories, animal mutilations and human abductions, you have to conclude that genetic material is being harvested.
Well, I reached for a rifle and I turned and looked, and it was already moving away, and it was descending the bluff. There's no way any human could have went down it. It was probably a 75 degree angle straight down almost.
On Richard Serrett's Strange Planet, we're redefining reality. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Do not go any further. Turn around. Go home.
Many of us have seen The Imitation Game. Have you seen The Imitation Game? And how course, is Bletchley yes. Park like? Yeah, is it like that? Was that exciting to see actually when that came out for you? Because you've been in and around this for so long.
Totally. Well, so I knew that the film was being made because of Twitter. So, you know, because I'd spent several years building up this whole community of thousands of people on Twitter that cared about Bletchley Park and code breaking and stuff and Alan Turing. So when I think when someone bought the script or there was a meeting about buying, the script in Hollywood, someone tweeted me about that. So, you know, so it was really interesting. So I kind of knew every step of the way through the film being produced, so which was probably like a 3 or 4 year period. I can't remember. You know, like all different points in what was happening. Cause I'm sure at some point, the sort of like the gossip was that Leonardo DiCaprio was going to be Alan Turing.
Oh, wow.
And then it was like, no, it's not. It's going to be Benedict Cumberbatch. So I don't know what happened there. Maybe he asked for too much money. I don't know. Or maybe that just...
It feels like it couldn't have been anyone but him now,
No,
it?
I know.
But maybe it would have been fine.
Yeah, who knows? Yeah. Yeah, and then when they were scouting for locations, so someone tweeted saying, oh, I've just seen this guy from Black Bear Productions get on the plane at LAX. He's coming over to scout for locations in the UK. So like while this, and also they said that, and he's not going to visit Bletchley Park as a potential location. So then while he was on the plane, the poor guy, I and others were saying, well, he's got to go to Bletchley Park. You know, so we're all tweeting saying, you've got to go to Bletchley Park, blah, 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 blah. You can't not go to Bletchley Park. And then, you know, so he must have got like, I don't know, 150, 5,000, I don't know, tweets when he got off the plane saying you've got to go to Bletchley Park. And then he did go to Bletchley Park. But they didn't use Bletchley Park as the main location. But apparently the reason was because it didn't look enough like Bletchley Park.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
Which doesn't make sense. But all I can think is it's not what the American audience, who of course will be the main audience for the film, would imagine Bletchley Park would look like, because they used a stately home kind of near Bletchley Park somewhere. But it is the scenes in the bar in the film are shot in the ballroom in Bletchley Park. So they have got some scenes there.
Because at least Bletchley got some money out of it then, I suppose.
I hope so. I didn't ask, but I hope so. They definitely got lots of publicity, which was amazing. Yeah, so I kind of like was, you know, knew about it all the way through. And then when it came out, or maybe it was just before it came out, there was a special kind of preview or something in North London
that I was invited to, along with someone that brought along an Enigma machine and one of the veterans and stuff. And then so we watched the film. I saw it for the first time in the audience, and then we were all up on the stage afterwards answering questions from the audience and stuff. And so I sat there like my husband watching the film. And, you know, I mean, it's a good film. It's definitely a good film. But it's just so inaccurate in terms of what actually happened that it's crazy. So, for example, Alan Turing didn't build that machine at all. He came up with the theoretical model for it with Gordon Welshman, one of the other codebreakers. But he didn't build it at all. And so, you know, so there's that. It was built by a guy called Doc Keane and his team.
Wow.
And, you know, so who didn't obviously in the film get any credit for what they did? That's a total liberty.
It's a massive liberty. It's just him standing around, because I rewatched it in advance of talking to you.
Oh, really? Oh, wow.
He's standing there. The whole film is about him and his machine.
Yeah. So that didn't happen.
You know what? There's another bit that it just didn't ring true at all when I was watching it. Because I think it is true that once they did figure out the codes and stuff, they decided that they couldn't couldn't use it too much because the Germans would know that we had this machine and change everything. Yeah. So they had to. And there's a scene in the film where one of the guys in there says, "But my brother's on this boat." And then Turing's going, "Well, we're not going to tell anyone." And I just thought maybe that order did happen, but not from him. He doesn't make that decision.
No.
It would be above him.
Yeah. And I don't think that happened either. So
they punched him. Oh, they punched him in the face.
Okay.
I just punched my microphone.
Bit of realism. Sound effects. So also the guy that ran Bletchley Park, so he's seen as like an ogre and a tyrant in the film. Whereas of course he's not, right? Because he's running the whole of Bletchley Park. Why would, you know, so of course he wasn't. So then, and I think they used his actual name in the film from what I can remember. So then, you know, I know not well, but I've met his relatives, his grandson. And so now everyone thinks his granddad is an awful person that tried to stop Alan Turing cracking the codes and saving the
Mark
war. Whereas,
was that Mark Strong who played that? There was the
I don't know who played it. I don't know who played it, but the actual person. I do know his name, but I've forgotten. But anyway, so there's loads of issues with it. And of course, you know, 8,000 women worked at Bletchley Park. How many women were in the film?
Keira Knightley.
One, yeah. So, you know, it was like 80% women at Bletchley, but, you know, that didn't come over either.
It didn't.
You know, and I know you need to have some kind of like evil person in there, but wasn't Hitler evil enough, you know, for the film?
Yeah, I suppose so, but he wasn't in it.
No, but, you know, they could have, I don't know.
Keira Knightley's parents are not nice because they don't like her sort of fraternizing with the... Is she a real character? The character she played, is that a real... Do you know if that's a real person?
Yeah, wasn't she? Was I've forgotten her name as well. Oh, I'm terrible at names.
I'm going to look it up.
Yes, but she was engaged to Alan Turing.
Right, Joan Clarke.
Joan Clarke. Yeah, so Joan Clarke was a real person who was a codebreaker.
Charles Dance.
Yeah, she was engaged.
Commander Charles Dance.
Okay, yeah. Yes, that's right. Yeah, he wasn't an ogre. And in fact, you know, there was only 6 people in the world who knew exactly what was going on at Bletchley Park. Churchill was one. He was another. And 4 other people, I guess, in intelligence or senior intelligence or whatever. So the people at Bletchley Park didn't know what each other were doing at all. You know, everything was very, very compartmentalised.
Of course. How does the machines
to keep
work?
Keep it secret.
So again, in my baby speak.
I can't tell you that because it's too complicated.
Is it?
Basically, the bomb machine, which is called Christopher in The Imitation Game, it's actually called the bomb machine, B-O-M-B-E, what it does is it kind of cranks through, given certain inputs, it cranks through all the different combinations and permutations for those inputs, and then comes up with various settings which could potentially be an answer to this is how to crack the code today, because the codes, because it changed every night at midnight to a new code, but it was the same way of breaking the codes every day but with different inputs, so you wouldn't know what the new code was for that day to kind of give us input.
I feel like I'm back in that class again at school.
I feel like I don't know
computing,
yeah, Don't ask me about anything technical.
I try to understand it in your book, and I've tried to Wikipedia it, and I've because you do explain it in your book, and I think for anybody who has an IQ slightly higher than mine, which is 99% of the world, they will actually be able to grasp the concept. But my head is just
no,
like
it is
swimming.
Complicated. No, it is complicated. It's not straightforward. I mean, if it was, it would have been easy, right? And it really wasn't easy. You know, there were three Polish mathematicians that that worked out how the Enigma machine worked. I think like before the Second World War. And Turing met up with them, I think, in Paris to discuss it with them and get some information from them. And then, but I think it was made, Enigma machine was made more complicated. So that he then had to kind of add extra bits onto that about how to break it and then come up with a theoretical model of a machine which could do that and then find someone, which was Doc Keane and his team, to actually build that machine.
Did it help to crack, I believe, maybe, because they had certain words that were always there to do, sometimes to do with the weather and sometimes Heil Hitler as well.
Yeah.
That seems like a massive oversight for such a complicated code
it's
from the
Germans. It's ridiculous, isn't it? Yeah, but you've got to think about, you know, it's loads of, you know, it'd be soldiers out in the field, you know, in trenches, typing in messages, you know, and so they're not all kind of like trained coding, you know, like, as in like cryptography experts or anything. They're probably just told to do this certain thing or following a few instructions in a booklet and doing it. So, you know, they might be told not to repeat stuff, but, you know, but they just did. You know, like Weather Report is one of them, and someone always put his girlfriend's name in it or something. Yeah. And then someone exactly retyped a message, which was a massive help in cracking the codes one time.
And what is this? They're typing something, are they? And it's going out into the airwaves, and we're intercepting that typing thing.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
You'll have so many people getting in touch with
you saying. You're overestimating the listener base and their engagement. They're not engaged. They're half listening to this while watching TV.
Okay.
Yeah,
so they're typing it in on an Enigma machine.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it's being transmitted. Mm. But I'm guessing it's being picked up by Morse code.
Mm.
Why don't I know the answer to that?
I haven't thought about it for a long time. I can take that bit out. I don't want you to feel like, you know, although you said you don't care, actually. So fuck them all anyway, but I can say, whatever. Whatever you want, I'll just, you know, you're a professor of computer science.
Don't make me sound stupid, please, Andrew.
You can't sound stupid. And the people I've had on here, you know, they are, if you're talking stupid, I mean, some of the stuff other Professor Sue Dame Black said, Dame Sue Black, absolute imbecile. No, she's not. She's very smart as well. She's smart. Quite smart. No, you're smart. Different stuff. She's smart about death and how
dead
she wants
bodies.
To die. Have you heard how she wants to die?
No.
She wants to. Well, when she dies, she wants to have her body like dissected by her own students. She wants them to really do away with everything and go like really deep into all that. She went like really explicitly. She was like the tissue and the muscle, and I want everyone to tear apart everything. And then when they're done, they'll have to do some sort of solution to get rid of all the rest of the sort of gristle and stuff. And then I want them to hang my skeleton up in my classroom to teach forever.
Wow. Yeah. Immortality. That's what immortality is, I guess.
I couldn't believe what
she's great. She's so down to earth about all that stuff.
Yeah. Well, yeah. That's for scary. It scared the shit out of me. But so what have you learned from talking to some of these code breaker people that you've met? Like, are there any particular ones whose stories you might want to tell, or like?
Yeah, sure. Really also, so we became really good friends with Captain Jerry Roberts and his family. He was one of the code breakers, and he was always campaigning for more recognition for the code breakers that aren't so well known. And in particular, Bill Tutt was one of them who he shared an office with at Bletchley Park, and. So he always used to tell the story of how, you know, he shared an office with Bill Tutt, who he didn't know very well. And he said Bill Tutt used to just sit in the office with a pencil and a piece of paper and just like jot something down now and again. And Jerry always used to say, you know, I couldn't work out, was he earning his corn? You know, like why was he being paid to sit there and he wasn't doing anything. And then he said, and actually then he realized he was a genius because he was just sitting thinking about how the Lorenz machine worked, and which is a bit similar to the Enigma machine, but different. And so he was sitting there working out all the inner workings of a machine, which would be like, you know, like Alan Turing did for Enigma, Bill Tutt did for Lorenz. So worked out how to create a machine, a theoretical model of the machine, which would then break the Lorenz. And so that machine was called Colossus, which and in terms of Bletchley Park, the Colossus and bomb rebuilds are still there at Bletchley Park and the, sorry, not at Bletchley Park, next door to Bletchley Park Museum at the National Museum of Computing. Both those machines are there, so you can go and visit them.
Why is Turing the name? Because there's several machines, apparently. Is it because of the movie, or was it before? It was a bit before that. Is it his story that the being punished?
I think
for
it's partly
gay?
His story, because it's just so tragic, really. But you know, there are lots of other people who have tragic stories as well. You know, like one of the code breakers. So I can't remember which one it was, but one of the people who worked at Bletchley Park was always telling this story. You know, kind of like talking about other codebreakers that work there and their amazing stories. And one of them was a major codebreaker at Bletchley Park who, you know, everyone was sworn to secrecy. They had to sign the Official Secrets Act when they'd started working there. And he had been a major codebreaker and then, you know, and didn't tell anybody. And his when speaking to his father on his father's deathbed, his father said to him, "You've never amounted to much, have you?" Right. And he didn't tell him even then that he had been one of the major codebreakers at Bletchley Park. And it's heartbreaking, heartbreaking stories. Wow. And I think actually, you know, it was quite hard for lots of people when the war ended because they couldn't say they'd worked at Bletchley Park. So for some of them, it's fine because they went into, you know, like special operations or whatever, or GCHQ. But for other people, they couldn't say that they'd worked at Bletchley Park because no one was allowed to talk about it. So particularly for the men, actually, you know, they would have been seen as cowards because they hadn't been soldiers.
This father, even if his son had amounted to nothing, I mean, that's quite a thing to say.
You wouldn't say that, would you? Well, you know, I wouldn't say that. But yeah, well, exactly. That's pretty dire. You know, but then there's other stories like Jean Valentine, who's one of the sort of lovely women that works at Bletchley Park that I got to know quite well as well. She told the story, you know, how she ended up at Bletchley Park. So she was at school. She was like an 18-year-old at school. And her headmaster recommended her to Bletchley Park, whoever was recruiting there, because she was really good at solving puzzles and like cryptic crosswords and stuff like that. So then she got asked to arrive at Bletchley Railway Station. She didn't know what for. And it was she lived in Scotland. So she said it's the first time she'd ever like left home. She left home, got the train down from Scotland down to Bletchley. And then she had no more instructions of what to do. So she just arrived at Bletchley Station. And I think she said it was like nighttime and didn't know what to do. So she asked like the guy that was on the station, the station master or whatever, "I've just been told to come here and I don't know what else to do." And he said, "Oh, it's just over the road. Just go over the road." So she's like, "Okay, then." So she goes over the road and there's the entrance to Bletchley Park. So it's not directly opposite anymore, but I think it was at the time during the war. So she went over the road and then, you know, got taken, sort of went through the kind of like sentry bit, then got taken into a room, I think one of the huts, where there was a guy sitting at a desk and also a soldier holding a gun kind of like in the corner. And she was told that she had to sign the Official Secrets Act. She was never allowed to tell anyone what she was going to be doing. But she didn't even know what it was she was going to be doing.
Wow.
And so, you know, you can just imagine an 18-year-old schoolgirl coming down, you know, first time away from home with all of that, you know. And she said she thought, you know, that kind of like she felt like the message was, "We'll kill you if you tell anybody." And that's why the soldier was there with the gun kind of standing in the background. So she signed and, you know, and then worked at Bletchley Park for several years. Work as one of the bomb operators, so operating one of the bomb machines.
Oh, right, yeah. The codebreaker bomb machine.
But, yeah.
Yeah.
The Alan Turing bomb machine. Yeah.
It's a really weird pact to sort of enter into. It's like if somebody says to you, like, "I'll tell you a secret," but you want to be like, "Well, hang on, I want to know what the secret is before I commit to keep it." Because what if it's but you just got to sign it because there's a bloke with a gun. But also, how exciting for her to sort of
go
down from Scotland.
So it's just like terrifying and really exciting at the same time.
There's nothing like that nowadays, is there? That kind of excitement. Maybe there's fear as well because the war.
Yeah,
going
we don't really want. Yeah, we don't really want that much excitement. I don't think.
That's sort of been lost nowadays though, because everyone's been everywhere. But that thing of being able to just like, I don't know, if you've never been down to sort of near London, isn't it? But actually, to sort of get on the train, you're moving from to a different country, it's the dead of night, you don't know where you go, you're 18. That's really exciting.
Yeah, it is.
What is, what's about now? Is it like there is a museum and everything there now?
People can visit. It's a 26 acre site still. So there's a big museum there. And there's also the National Museum of Computing next door, which has got all of the computing heritage stuff there. So it's worth visiting both places.
Yeah, I want to check that out at some point. Mm. I can't believe I've never been there, actually. Where is it? Is it up near, North London?
It's in Bletchley. Yeah, it's 50 miles north of London. So are you based in London?
Well, I'm Berlin.
But you're in Berlin.
But I'm Berlin, I'll be back.
I forgot. I can't remember anything.
I'm in bloody Berlin. My family's in Watford, so can't be.
You can get on the train from Watford. I think it's only 36 minutes from London, from Euston. I think from Watford it's maybe 20 minutes. So you've got no excuse.
I want
a full report when you've been. Full report.
I'll send it to you in Morse code. See if you can crack it.
Yeah, that sounds great.
It was a lot of fun talking to Sue. We really had a good laugh and it was incredibly informative. I'm so happy to have learned. I mean, I didn't know anything really about Bletchley Park, so I'm really delighted to know a little bit more. And I hope you listeners are also happy to have learned a bit more about it. So thank you, Sue, for coming on. We all owe a debt to her for keeping such an important and historic place open. Remember to get her book, Saving Bletchley Park. There's a link in the show notes. If anyone can think of a third Professor Sue Black that I should talk to, do let me know. But otherwise, just check out episode 37 with the other Sue. She's absolutely fascinating too, and talks about death and carrying heads secretly on a plane. Thank you again to my sponsor, Beer52. Just go to beer52.com/edge and pay £5.95 postage to get your free beers. If you're one of the newbies that were hooked in by the Apple Carousel feature, do subscribe to this podcast for more interviews with fascinating people and get the bonus interviews each week on patreon.com/AndrewGold or just the Patreon app. Here's a snippet of this week's bonus interview with Sue when she talks about what happened, quite a funny story, when she was invited onto Desert Island Discs. What did you say on Desert Island Discs?
What did I say?
Were you nervous? Oh, man.
No, I was really excited. When I got an email saying we'd like you to be on Desert Island Discs just before I was about to get on a plane to Amsterdam with my daughter. It's half term. I was going to give a talk in Amsterdam. And I got the email and I was like, oh my God, Leah, my youngest daughter. So she would have been about 14 then. Leah, I'm going to be on Desert Island Discs. Oh my God, oh my God. And she was like, what's that? And I was like, I've got to tell people. So I tweeted, I'm going to be on Desert Island Discs. Then when we got on the plane. And then we got off the other end. My phone rings. It's my agent.
Wrong Sue Black.
Oh, you're so rude. No, we've both done it, actually. I think she did it before me.
Bloody hell.
And so it was my agent saying, you're not allowed to tell anyone. You're going to be on Desert Island Discs. I was like, oh, shit. What should I do? She's like, delete the tweets. I was like, oh my God. Delete all the tweets. Yeah. So I thought maybe they'd tell me I couldn't do it then. But it was all fine in the end.
So that was just 1 minute out of the 15 or so of the bonus interview this week. You can get that on patreon.com/AndrewGold or on the Patreon app. Thank you to this week's new patron. That's Ruth Hannah Van Stratton. And if you can, everyone, I'd love to hear reviews, or read reviews rather, from you on Apple. You can do it just in the app. And here are last week's newest reviews. Somebody called Killing Time Daily in the United States wrote, excellent, with 4 exclamation marks. I really, really is in capitals, enjoyed the interview with the plane crash survivor. Highly recommended, 4 exclamation marks again. Thank you for all the work you put in. Well, thank you so much. I really loved editing that one. That was last week's one with Coche Inciarte, who survived 72 days in the Andes and had to eat the dead to survive. It's had quite possibly the best reception of any of my episodes so far. People really enjoyed listening to Koche. It was just so emotional, and I found myself crying while editing it, which is unusual, because there is possibly no better example in history of human perseverance. Amazing guy, Koche Inciarte. So if you haven't listened yet, do check that one out. And JJ2203, probably someone who was born on the 22nd of March, which is the day after my birthday, the 21st of March, JJ is in the UK and wrote, "Just brilliant. I've listened to so many as I started from the beginning and am working my way backwards. I love the guests and they are all so different. Not sure what I'm going to do when they end." Ah, thanks, JJ. And don't you worry about them ending. I'll just keep making these episodes every week on Mondays. Speaking of which, in the next couple of weeks, I'm chatting to a really inspiring and amazing woman, South African Olivia Jackson, a stuntwoman and martial arts expert who had a tragic accident while doing a stunt for the Resident Evil movie and lost her arm as a result. She's really inspirational, so do tune in for that. And also, I think, or hope, I'm speaking to Linda Calvi, known as the Black Widow. From the criminal underworld, Linda is known for killing her husband. I'm not sure which order those two episodes will be in, but tune in next week to find out.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.